All right, and it is time now for Brazos Valley Beat. And my name is Ann, and I'll be subbing for Jay today. And boy, do we have a treat for you. I'll be talking the full hour with David Todd about his new book, The Texas Landscape Project. I spoke with him, I had an interview with him 5 years ago in 2010 about the initial project, which was the Texas Legacy Project. And I'll have him explain just what that is and how these two are connected. But the Texas Legacy Project, what we're talking about today is the book. I think there's some websites associated with it, and it's a big project. It's like a Texas Nature Atlas, an environmental atlas. And David is the founder and coordinator of the Conservation History Association of Texas. He has worked as an attorney on environmental cases, as a donor for conservation causes, a cattle rancher, and as co-author of the oral history compilation I just told you about, the Texas Legacy Project. He has also served on the boards of Audubon Texas, the Texas Conservation Alliance, the Texas League of Conservation Voters, and the Lone Star Chapter of the Sierra Club. All right, David, well, let me cue you up and so we can get ready and let you start talking. But I did want to start this interview by talking about the Texas Legacy Project. And that was a project of your Conservation History Association. Tell our listeners what that was, what it involved, and how it came to eventually give birth to this Texas Landscape Project.
Legacy Project, which was this first effort a number of years ago, and then this more recent project, which we call the Texas Landscape Project. Thanks again. It's really a treat to be able to share these stories with your audience.
Well, I always love having you on and sharing these projects because they result in big, beautiful books about Texas and environmental causes. So what could be better?
Well, thank you very much. That's very flattering.
Okay.
So you asked about the Texas Legacy Project, which I think, as you pointed out, was a book that we came out with in 2010 from Texas A&M Press, it in turn was based on a video archive that is at texaslegacy.org, and it's that's a collection of interviews with over 230. Conservationists from around the state. There are people from the Panhandle, and people from the lower Rio Grande Valley, and people from the Trans-Pecos, and people from the Big Thicket.
I think what was one of the wonderful aspects of that project is when you say conservationists, it's not like they were official conservationists. Some of these people were just regular blue-collar working people that felt a passionate desire to preserve some aspect of the environment.
That's true. It was a real gamut of people and a real wide variety. Some people were game wardens, there were hunters, fishermen, cattle ranchers, farmers, engineers, scientists of many stripes,
housewives,
politicians, and housewives, and people that came to this really as amateurs without any formal training, but quickly became experts in protecting their corner of Texas. And that was, so it was a wonderful education about land and water and energy and pollution and a host of different topics in the state. It looked at through the eyes of people in those communities where these issues were most immediate. And so I felt like it was important to try to record and preserve their stories, and so we would go to these little communities and get maybe 2 or 3 hours of time with these different stewards of their communities or their ecoregion or their watershed, and then record them, and then we would make little videos that were edited down to something that might be more I guess concise about what they were trying to say or do. And once we had compiled all this material, Shannon Davies, who was an editor at Texas A&M Press at the time, said, well, you know, this video and these databases and so on that are online might make a good book. And so that was the basis of this book that came out called The Texas Legacy Project, Stories of Courage and Conservation. Came out in 2010, as we said, and that was how you and I first met, because we talked about that book, and you were kind to give us a little exposure about the volume that came out then.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did that work then lead you to create this book, The Texas Landscape Project, which is not interviews but is maps. So it's a very different way of looking at our landscape and nature and people, but it's also full of stories, and it covers the whole of Texas. So how did you decide to work from that perspective?
Well, that's a good question. The original effort, this Texas Legacy Project, was really based on spoken word. You know, it was how people talk in the real world about things that are important to them. And it wasn't essays or articles or white papers about sort of the formal view of environmental problems. It was sort of idiosyncratic, subjective views of people's life and experience and things that were very dear to their hearts. So when we came out with this book that was based on these, this same wonderful woman, Shannon Davies, said, well, what do you think about doing a sequel? Because we had only been able to include about a quarter of the people we'd interviewed in the actual book. And so I think that she might have had in mind doing some kind of a second volume. But she was very understanding when we said, well, how about if we did different take on this same effort of trying to capture stories about environmental protection and public health protection in the state. And what we proposed was, instead of looking at these sort of idiosyncratic views of people's lives and the spoken word, instead we thought, well, we can go to some of these enormous data banks, these data sets that are being set up by agencies and academics, and build maps. So instead of having an audio record, you know, like what we might be producing here at the radio station, instead it would be a visual kind of representation. And in that way, it might sort of hit on different chords with people. Rather than listening to this information, they might be able to see it and look at it in terms of visual materials. And then secondly, this would be geographic. So we'd really be talking about, instead of people's views as we did before, this would be more based on place and, you know, communities and a given river basin or an airshed or an ecoregion. And then lastly, I think that it would be based on data, you know, just very objective information that's been collected by the Environmental Protection Agency or the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, or it could be a county appraisal district. But there's gobs of data out there that's, it's all numbers. It's bits and bytes. It's ones and zeros. And so it's very different than the sort of stories that people tell from their day-to-day experience. But the really cool thing is, and thank the Lord that Shannon approved this project, because the two books, they mesh pretty nicely, because you got an audio version, you got a video or a graphic version, and you know, you've got a subjective version, and you've got a very objective data-based kind of approach, and you've got something that's based on people, and you've got one that's based on place. And so I'm hoping that when people look at the first book, Texas Legacy Project, and then they look at this second book, Texas Landscape Project, that something will ring a bell with them, that in one way or another, it will speak to them about conservation in the state.
Well, we should let the listeners know, too, that, that when we mention maps and graphs, I mean, it's not just a staid, you know, general map. These are maps that highlight aspects of the terrain and then the graphs, and it's very colorful. And it also shows in certain areas how the changes have occurred through the various colorful maps. And so it's visually, it's just a wonderful book to look through. And it really, like I'm looking here at the parts that are like the Galveston coast, and it shows how the coastline is changing and how the coastline is shrinking. And it shows it very, very easily to a layman with the colors that are overlaid on the maps. So the maps are not just like one map of an area. It's showing the changes in the terrain for various areas. The book is also organized in five sections. It's the sections. What I wanted you to do before we get into the sections, though, is to talk about how you managed to think about organizing this book as far as Texas landscape, because it's so large and multifaceted, and the terrain and the wildlife. How did you figure out how you were going to organize it? Was that easy?
Well, it's like a fruit. You can slice it in many different ways. We chose to break it down into, as you said, five major parts: land, water, air quality, wildlife, and energy. And then within those five areas, there are 40 chapters, and it was important to us to try to have representative chapters from as many parts of the state as we could have. And so there are stories, say, from southeast Texas that talk about the protection of the Big Thicket, but then there are stories from out in west Texas that talk about lead pollution in El Paso around the Asarco smelter. And then we talk about things in the Panhandle. We try to discuss a little bit about the problems that the Ogallala Aquifer are facing. And then we go down to the Rio Grande Valley, and we talk about issues involving the colonias and the border wall. So we try to be as comprehensive as we can, but it's not easy because this is a big, diverse state. And I should add that one of the ways that we started to put this book together was really it's a kind of a conversation between me and my co-author, Jonathan Ogren, who's a data analyst and a map maker and a geographer and a biologist. And so a lot of the development of the book is really the result of this sort of back and forth between two people who care about the state and have this conversation and try to pull it together and sort of a record of our understanding of it and then share it with the rest of the public.
Well, who was responsible for the text? Because the text, as wonderful as the wonderful, colorful photographs and maps are, the text is also wonderfully written, and a lot of historical information, a lot of information that could be very complex is written in a way that's very easy to grasp. So I was wondering, and there's so much information when I was going through this book for this interview, I kind of had to almost back off because I would want to talk about every single section. Was very interesting from each of the parts. But so who wrote the text?
I did.
Wow.
I should talk a little bit about how Jonathan and I tried to split up the work, because he is the co-author and it was a team. And typically the way it would work is that I would try and research a topic, write a draft, provide data for some maps, and then Jonathan would look at that data very hard and make sure that the information was complete and it reflected something that we could claim and support. And then he would make these really beautiful finished maps on the basis of, you know, having kind of reviewed the data. I hope people are pleased with the way it looks. I think Texas A&M did a nice job of putting all these maps and laying it out. There are over 300 maps in the book and over 100 images. And so it was sort of a complicated jigsaw puzzle for them to put together. But I think that they did a really nice job.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit biased, but I think they really did.
Well, they did. It is an absolutely stunning book. But as I said, I am also amazed by the amount of information and historical information that is contained in all the different aspects that you look at. Here's one on the storms in the Texas coast. And within that, you will, you know, have information on the buildings and the shorelines and how they were affected and flood costs, and then stories of specific storms. So did you have to research extensively for those for what you chose to write about in the book, or was it things that you were somewhat familiar with?
Well, I think like most of your listeners, we catch a little glimmer of a story from, you know, the top of the news or the headlines in the newspaper or what somebody might tell us. But usually I'd have to read up a lot about these things, because I think that most of these environmental issues are complicated, complex, deep-rooted issues that go back decades. And so it's not something that I think we're often exposed to when we read something or hear it on the radio or see it on TV or notice it on our laptop. And so that was part of the point of trying to pull together this environmental history atlas, is to dig into some of these issues and see, well, what's the long-term pattern? What are the long-range trends? And you mentioned the coastal hazards chapter. It talks a lot about tropical storms and hurricanes. And it focuses on one particular hurricane that hit Houston called Hurricane Ike, that came ashore in 2008, and it caused a massive evacuation of the city, and it hundreds of thousands of people lost power, and, you know, chemical plants were shut down, and police stations were closed, and schools were shuttered. It was a major storm, but it wasn't a unique storm. And so what we try to talk about in the book is that there have been literally hundreds of storms before that, and they all take basically the same route, and they cause the same kind of havoc, and that it's important for us to understand that if we want to go down and enjoy the coast and, you know, get in the ocean and swim around and sail and, you know, have barbecues on the beach, that we should appreciate that it's as pleasant a place as it is, it's also a dangerous place to build a house or to have a building of any kind. And that we should always sort of keep in mind that there are risks of that environment. You know, for years, I think we worried about what Mother Nature could do to us. And I think as time has gone on, we feel like, well, we have lots of warning systems and we have secure buildings. But nevertheless, you know, Mother Nature often bats last, and it's important that we have a healthy respect for the kind of hazards that the natural environment can bring to us. And so that's something that we tried to highlight without being hysterical about it, but just to say that these are real issues with a long history, and maybe some of these maps can suggest, you know, some of the ways to understand the risks and then to mitigate them as well.
Right. Well, that brings to mind when you mentioned that there's a long history of those storms, and people get a little more hysterical as the population grows and becomes more dense. They feel like it's a more dramatic effect. But I come from West Texas, and it brings to mind several years ago there was they had an earthquake, but there's not very many people, so it didn't hurt anything because there's not buildings and there's not tall buildings and there's not a lot of people. So so sometimes the effect of Mother Nature can be more dramatic when there is a denser population, certainly.
Well, and, you know, I think that's a good point to bring up because one of the themes that we kept running across when we were producing the book was that Texas still has, I think, kind of a mythos of being a wide open state, you know, with you know, great vistas and broad horizons and no people. But that's really not so. And I was a while back, I was looking at some population records, and when my grandfather was born in Hearne, Texas, 116 years ago, there were 3 million people in Texas. Now there are 9 times as many people here. So I think it's important to think of the folks that are being put at risk by the development patterns that we've chosen. You know, we have this kind of low density, sprawling development that goes throughout Texas. And, you know, I drive a car and I enjoy being able to drive wherever I want, park wherever I want. But, you know, that kind of growth does take us to places that are dangerous. You know, think about the coast, or that are precious. And you think about a park or a natural preserve. And all those problems are sort of magnified by the fact that there aren't just 3 million of us now, there are 27 million of us. And so everything is multiplied because of that. And so I'm hoping that when people look through the book, they start to recognize that while the outline of Texas, that really, you know, iconic shape of Texas hasn't changed, and the rivers are the same and the ecoregions are the same, the thing that's changed is us, that there are millions and millions of more people here. And, you know, there's the anticipation that there are going to be many, many more Texans. So I think we need to take into consideration the growth that we've already have and try to plan for what may come in the coming decades.
Well, this is a good chance to ask the question that I heard asked on another interview, but it was such a good question, I wanted to pose it to you again. And that is, what do you think Texas will look like in 100 years?
Well,
giving the information you have gleaned through this research.
It's I think that it's going to be a very urban place. You know, we're comparing 1900 with the present day. I think that in 1900, this state was 80% rural. In other words, 80% of those 3 million people lived in small towns and out on ranches and farms, and 20% lived in the bigger cities. But now it's exactly flipped, and actually probably more so. It's like 85% live in cities and 15% live in small towns and you know, out in the rural areas. So I think that 100 years from now, it's going to be a much more urban place. I think that's probably clear. Another thing that will probably be true, my crystal ball is not entirely clear, but a lot of the growth is happening along the IH-35 corridor, you know, which goes basically from Dallas down to Temple and Austin and San Antonio. And so I think there'll be a lot of people there. There'll be a lot of people in the Golden Triangle of you know, Houston and Beaumont and Galveston. And then down in the lower Rio Grande Valley, there's very rapid growth there too. So I think that those are two things that are going to happen. We're going to have a lot more people, and they're going to be more urban, and they'll be in those three basic areas, from what I understand. And then from a natural aspect, I think that, you know, while there are some folks that really aren't seeing the signs of climate change, I think that the writing is unfortunately on the wall, and we're going to have a much drier state for a large part of the western part of the state, and a lot of the areas are going to be much warmer than they were as well. So in other words, West Texas, you might imagine, is going to move east. South Texas is going to move north. And then, we're going to be clustered in this sort of I-35 corridor and then down along the coast and down in lower Rio Grande Valley. That's my view of the future. Cloudy as it probably is.
Okay. Well, in using the maps to show the changes and the diagrams and the landscape, you mentioned that you did notice patterns. Were there any that were very unexpected to you? Did you have any surprises?
Unexpected patterns. Yeah, I mean, I think that some of the patterns are easy to see. You know, you can notice where people live, and a lot of that is you can see it from space. And we did one chapter is on light pollution, and you can see the light signature for a city and its suburbs and even out into its exurban area that may be 50, 60 miles from the center of a town. That can be seen, 100 miles up in space. But then there are things that are really difficult to see. And I think one of those would be, where are the native prairies? There are probably less than a tenth of a percent of the tall grass blackland prairies left in Texas. And, they're scattered among railroad right-of-ways and cemeteries and little hay meadows that farmers have protected over the years, but they're few and far between. So it was fascinating to see when we were developing a chapter on grasslands to see some of the recent research that shows where these are and to try to map them and describe them for people who are interested and concerned about prairies.
Well, what does the loss of prairies affect? I'm sure it's a multitude of things, but so our listeners have an idea what the ripple effect of the loss of these native grasses.
Texas, I think historically was, there's the piney woods in East Texas, but basically it's a grassland state, and when Native Americans lived here, and when early settlers came to Texas, these miles of grassland is what they saw, and so that was kind of the big landscape they saw. But also the density and diversity of a given plot. Some of these prairies had 250, 300 species of grasses and forbs just being wildflowers and sedges and. And so they were wonderfully diverse and rich. So from a cultural standpoint and like a scientific standpoint, that was, I think, really remarkable. But and then you think about how the state was developed as a grazing state, cattle and sheep and goats. And so the grasslands were a really important part of how the state was built. And then you fast forward and prairies, I think, are important in ways that maybe our predecessors didn't really appreciate. And I'd give a few examples. One is that these prairie grasses have the wonderful ability to sequester carbon. So as we get into a carbon-limited world, as climate change accelerates, these grasslands are really, really important. Another aspect is that when we get a big rainstorm that comes in, one of these, I think people have called them rain bombs, you get 10 inches in a day, 20 inches. And Houston received a 22-inch rainfall back in April of 2016. This happens now, and these wonderful grasslands that we used to have, because they have really deep root systems, maybe 10, 15 feet down, they have this wonderful ability to soak up and store rainfall and not allow it to run off and flood us and our neighbors. Another thing that's really important about prairies is that they When they catch rainfall, they also filter out all the gunk that might be in the runoff, so that it's caught and it restores fertility to the soil, but it doesn't add pollution to the creeks and streams and bios that might receive that runoff. So in lots of ways, prairies are really important. And I might add one last thing, is that they're the home for just a wonderful variety of animals. You know, of course, the bison of years ago, but also if you're a hunter, you know, the bobwhite quail, that's their home. And or if you're a birder, you know, that's where you'll find the meadowlarks. So it's just such a rich place, and it's such a part of our culture that I'm hoping that people will appreciate it, see the maps in the book, and say, you know, I want to go see a prairie for myself, and maybe start plant one in my front yard. You can do it, and you wouldn't have to mow it.
Oh, great. Well, you are listening. Let me remind you, you are listening to Brazos Valley Beat. My name is Ann, and I am talking to David Todd, and we are discussing his wonderful book, The Texas Landscaped Project. But I'm going to take a little break right now and let you all go get a glass of water, do whatever, stretch your feet out, and then we'll be back in about 3 minutes. And I think I've got an appropriate tune queued up, and that would be Miles and Miles of Texas.
Texas, yeah. I was born in Louisiana, down on the old bayou, raised on shrimp and catfish and mammy's good gumbo. I got that rambling fever, said goodbye to Ma and Pa, cross that old Red River, and this is what I saw. I saw miles and miles of Texas, all the stars up in the skies. I saw miles and miles of Texas, gonna live there till I die. Oh, Danny and Bill. In the cowtown, the cradle of the West. Just ask any cowboy, he'll tell you it's the best. I met a Texas beauty, got friendly with her pa. I looked into her big blue eyes, and this is what I saw. I saw miles and miles of Texas, all the stars up in the sky. I saw miles and miles of Texas, gonna live there till I die. All lucky now. I started taming broncos, made every rodeo, until I met a rough one, his name was Devil Joe. I grabbed hold of his bridle to ride this old outlaw. He threw me from the saddle, and this is what I saw. I saw miles and miles of Texas, all the stars up in the sky. I saw miles and miles of Texas, gonna live there till I die. Oh, fiddles now.
Oh, yes, Miles and Miles of Texas. And I wanted to play that because I'm talking to David Todd, and we are talking about his book, The Texas Landscape Project. And during that, I'm sure that he thought about, drove, discussed, studied miles and miles of Texas, because it is a big, beautiful, colorful type of atlas for Texas terrain and land, air, and water. And speaking of, that's what I wanted to start this second half of the program with, David, talking a little bit about just kind of taking through the book in the sections and let him talk a little bit about what he discovered and what he feels is important. The first section was land, and when we left off, we were talking about the prairie grasses, which I started reading up on that, and yeah, I didn't realize the extent of the loss. But David, why don't you talk a little bit about the section that deals with land and how you approached it and what you found out?
Sure, I'd be glad to give it a try. I guess the starting point for most discussions about land in Texas and in this atlas are that when Texas joined the Union, 1845, the state of Texas, formerly the Republic, had 225 million acres of land in the public name. Fast forward, 170 years now, and we have less than 3% of the state held publicly, and the rest is in private hands. And so that gives worry for some and hope for others. I mean, worry because it's becoming more and more difficult for many city dwellers to have a nearby piece of open space to go visit, and whether they want to hunt or fish or go birding or just have a picnic with their family. So that's a concern, you know, given the lack of public lands, and particularly because most of the public lands, the big tracts, you think of Big Bend National Park, are hundreds of miles from the major population centers. So, you know, I think that that's going to be a continuing challenge for the state, is to provide parks and open space for people who live in Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, San Antonio, Houston, so on, College Station, Bryan. On the other hand, because there's all this private land, there are some opportunities, and there are two that come to mind. One is that that there are these things called wildlife co-ops that allow people to work together. You know, landowners that abut one another can join together and pool their resources, pool their equipment, pool their know-how, work with the state agencies to get technical advice, and manage their land in concert for whether they're trying to produce better deer or more birds or more butterflies or whatever it might be. Because it's privately held, you know, these landowners have a real stake and an incentive to try to do their best job. Another thing that I think is promising in that there's so much private land is that there are these incentives now, which for years there was something called the agricultural tax exemption, which basically gave a lower tax rate, maybe a 90% discount for people who had corn or soybeans or cows on their land. But I guess it's been about 20 years now. That exemption has been extended for people who want to develop their land for wildlife. So they don't have to have a cow roaming in that pasture. They could say, I just want to use it for hunting. And they could put out a feeder for the deer, or they could put out a hummingbird feeder, or, you know, whatever is their greatest interest. And so that has a wonderful potential to protect the land that's in private hands. But like many of the issues in the book, I'm trying to share with folks kind of my understanding and Jonathan's understanding that there are pluses and minuses to our situation in Texas, and whether it's dealing with land or many other aspects.
Well, at the end of the section on prairies and pastures, you have a short section titled Healing. Can you talk about that? Because it gave a very interesting perspective on the people's efforts to rebuild and restore grasslands, which seems like an impossible task, and may yet be.
Well, there is very little virgin prairie left in the state. That's a shame. But there are some people who are nuts about prairies, and I count myself one of them. And there are groups. There's the Native Prairie Association of Texas. There's the Wildlife Habitat Federation. The Katy Prairie Conservancy down in Houston. And what they are doing is developing seed sources, special cultivars. The state has been a great partner in that. And they are replanting areas that were formerly prairies but have been converted over the years to, exotic old-world grasses. They're also doing things that are much less kind of intensive and expensive. They're doing things like grazing in a rotation where they'll move the cattle or whatever kind of livestock they've got every week or maybe every day, and they're trying to mimic the way bison used to move through and graze really intensively and then move on, and that would allow these grasses and forbs and sedges to regrow before they came back around in 2 or 3 months. And so with these new grazing techniques, there's ways to promote these native grasses that really could be very promising in seeing these grasses back. Another way that I think we're starting to see folks trying to manage their land for prairies is they're bringing fire back. Prescribed burns can be a really good tool for opening the ground and trying to trigger some of these grasses to start growing again. So, there's 100,000 years of seed in the ground. If there are ways to try to give those grasses and those seeds the chance to propagate, I think that we've got a good future.
Well, there's also a section on ports and railroads, and that brings issues that affect many here in Brazos Valley and the rural areas. So let's talk a little bit about that section of the book and the history that is told.
Sure. The ports and railroads are interesting in themselves because you think about the development of the state and the cities. You look at the city logo for Houston, and it's got a railroad engine on there. And so railroads were a really key part of our development. And of course, the Port of Houston is one of the largest employers and one of the biggest economic drivers in the Houston area. For our atlas, these ports and railroads were kind of a nice landmark for trying to understand how East Texas was developed, because the Piney Woods and the Bottomland hardwoods were heavily logged from the 1890s really through the current day. But it's very difficult to parse out, well, where were these areas cut? But one of the ways you can find out is by finding where those old ports were in East Texas. There are a bunch on these coastal bayous and rivers, and also where the old railroads were, because that's when they would cut these trees, they had to get them out of the forest and get them to the sawmills and get them to a port to then ship them out to the markets. So we were able to find some old maps, for example, of what they called spurs, which were temporary railroads that were laid down in these forests. And they might be there for just a year or so, but they would be used for pulling the logs out of the woods. And then maybe 6 months or a year later, they'd pick up those tracks and move them to the next forest and cut that and then move to the next forest and so on. And in that sense, from about 1890 to 1915, all of East Texas was clear cut. And so the forests we see now are maybe a fourth or fifth growth. And the only way to sort of turn back the clock to that first growth was to look and find those old ports and those old railroad tracks.
Wow. Such is the fascinating information that is contained in this wonderful book. I'm going to say it for our listeners again. It's the Texas Landscape Project, and we have a little more time, but it's published at A&M Press, and you can find out any information if you want to see this wonderful book and purchase it for yourself. We're going to move on to water. That's another section, and water is always important in Texas. It was very important today. We got just a little bit, but can you talk about what that section covers and some of the concerns for water? This has some of the most fascinating maps in the book, with showing aquifers and various, you know, streams and this and that, and how they change. I mean, there's multiple maps showing multiple things, but talk about water.
Well, sure. I think water is the stuff of life, and so it's probably one of the most important environmental issues that we face. And you know, we want to make sure that we've got water for people to drink and for agriculture to use, and to cool our power plants and so on. It's got a political aspect to it beyond our economy, and that is that people are moving, as we talked about before, to the lower Rio Grande Valley and to the Interstate 35 corridor. And these have, you know, they got wonderful, vibrant cities with interesting culture and you know, active economies. But those people live a long way away from the source of the water that's reliable in the state, you know, which is largely in the Sabine and the Trinity, you know, towards the eastern part of the state. So there's this political tension between areas that are rich in people and economic might, and then areas that are rich in water. And you know, how do you balance the needs of those places where water originates and where the water might eventually be used? And you know, we're already seeing a lot of interbasin transfers. I think there are over 78 of them that have been permitted, where water is moved from one watershed to the next. So you can sort of see the future, that's, I think, one interesting aspect that is borne out by some of the maps in the book. A couple other interesting issues have more to do with groundwater, and Texas is unique in having something called the rule of capture that goes back to a Texas Supreme Court ruling in about 1900. And basically it says that if you can drill a well and turn on a pump, the water that pump captures is yours. You have title to that. And it doesn't matter if you dewater your neighbor's well or if you make his or her land subside. It's nevertheless, you are pretty much protected. And so this has run out into, you know, pretty serious problems. You know, the Ogallala Aquifer is being drained, essentially. It's a fossil aquifer. It has very little water coming into it, but there's a lot of water coming out of it to irrigate crops. And because there's not any sort of recourse for people who overpump their aquifer, it's very difficult to manage. And there's some groundwater conservation districts that are trying to do a good job, but it's a big challenge. And then you think about areas closer to us here in College Station and Bryan. There were wells that were drilled. I mean, I think hundreds of thousands that were drilled in the Houston area, and some of them in the area around Baytown and the eastern end of the Houston Ship Channel resulted in very serious land surface subsidence, where there was a community called Brownwood that dropped by 10 feet. And so it literally went underwater and had to be evacuated and abandoned. And so there's a lovely marsh there now, but once, 30 years ago, there were homes and swimming pools and garages and people and cars, but that land is literally sunk under Galveston Bay's waters because of all the groundwater that was pumped out of the Chico and the Evangeline aquifers underground. So there are these aspects to how we use water and how we conserve and manage our water that are really important. And I hope that people look at the book and think, you know, how do we deal with growth in the state and how do we deal with emergencies? You know, we've seen in the past the Rio Grande did not reach the Gulf in the year 2002. Guadalupe River is, in case of, if all water rights were exercised in the Guadalupe, I think that people believe that about 9% of the water would be left in the river during a drought. So we're already in a difficult straits with water, and I think as we, you know, look forward to the future, we need to be very cognizant of that and make sure that we're careful about how we use our water resources.
Well, very quickly, I'm afraid we're going to, we have about 10 more minutes, so we can touch on the section on air and maybe a bit of the wildlife, which I really enjoyed. But I'll, to end the section with the water, I did send you a link because in our newspaper, and so I thought our listeners might enjoy hearing your take, Brian has just recently got an $18 million loan to fund water conservation efforts, and I believe we're going to do some underground aquifers. And so I'm just wondering, and there's just a few other cities that got the loans to do that. What you think about that aspect of or that way of trying to conserve water? Do you think it's a healthy way, a healthy direction?
Sure, I do. I think it's really inventive. After the great drought of the 1950s, Texas went on a dam building spree and built, we now have 180 major surface water reservoirs. But since those reservoirs were built, we've realized that, evaporation is a big issue. You know, you put water in the reservoir, but a lot of it goes up in the air. Or you start having eutrophication problems where, you know, these reservoirs start to turn green and slimy and full of algae, and they're going through the natural process of dying. And also these reservoirs take up farm and ranch land, and they consume bottomland hardwoods, and they have really serious impacts on the estuaries in the state as well. Things that really weren't understood and maybe anticipated back in the 50s and 60s when a lot of these reservoirs were built. So the nice thing about this project that Brian is embarking on is that the water will be injected underground and captured in aquifers, and that way it won't evaporate. It'll be there for use, and you can in a pretty reliable way. And you won't have to consume these very valuable bottomlands that otherwise would have to be used to create a reservoir footprint. So I think it's a really cool idea, and I hope that other cities take a good close look at what Brian is doing.
Okay, on the section about air, what do you? I'm going to have to skim through because once again, this wonderful, but we're running out of time. But what, in your opinion, poses the biggest danger to clean air in Texas with all of your research? Or is there any one thing?
Well, I think. What always gives me pause and troubles me is that we all benefit from a modern economy that produces wonderful products, but there are some communities that get hit with disproportionate impacts. And I'm thinking about I think they call them the fence line communities. You know, if you've got a petrochemical plant and it makes all sorts of handy things like gasoline or plastic bags or medical, supplies, but they're putting stuff up the stack, and a lot of that is having really powerful impacts on the community that surrounds many of these plants. And I don't think we've yet really worked out a way to protect those communities and to recognize that they are taking a greater impact than the rest of us that are benefiting from these same plants. And so I think that's something that I worry about. I think there's one thing I'm encouraged by is that there's something called the Toxic Substances Control Act that was just reenacted, renewed in the last month or so. And it's going to empower the federal government to do a lot more serious reviews of new chemicals that are being introduced into the market. And I think that that'll make it much safer, because for many years, chemical manufacturers weren't required to prove the safety of their chemicals. And I think that in that sense, you know, thousands of chemicals have been introduced into the natural environment without really being vetted. And so I'm hoping that that'll start to protect some of the fence line communities as well as the public at large.
Well, each one of the sections, and we weren't even able to touch on two of them, ends with something with a chapter about some aspect of wildlife. The water one ended with the, which I was hoping we would be able to talk about a little bit, but the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle, which looked like a wonderful story. But I also want to have you talk about the monarchs, which was at the end of the air section. So what do the monarchs represent as far as Texas wildlife?
Well, I think monarchs are an example of
4 minutes
of how we're all connected. And I think that that is a theme that I hope readers see throughout the book, is that you know, people are connected with the natural kingdom, and monarch butterflies, I think, demonstrate this in that they've lost about 90% of their population over recent years, and that's because of problems in what's called the Oyamel fir forest down in the Mexican highlands of central Mexico, where a lot of those trees have been cut down, and that's where the monarchs go during the winter to roost. They're also having problems because they go up to the Midwest into the Farm Belt, and there they survive on milkweed. But we've become so efficient with farming for corn and soybeans and so on that most of those milkweed are gone, and so the monarch butterflies are really facing a kind of double whammy from both their southern end of their habitat and their northern. And so, you know, Texas being sort of in the middle, you know, we have enormous migration that goes through Eagle Pass and then across the state, is seeing that we are intimately connected with what happens in central Mexico and in the Farm Belt in the Midwest, and that we are also connected with this small insect that we've, you know, been able to enjoy, you know, whether a school kid or a grown up, for our entire lives.
Well, there's also, I think that would, talking about the migration, that would also highlight like the whooping cranes, where, you know, when Texas is just in the middle of these migratory paths, we get to enjoy for short periods each year a wonderful variety of species. But what about birds? And again, we're just down to another minute or two. I tell you what, we're just going to have to ask our listeners to check out the book, because there was so much we didn't touch on. Billboards. There's a section, I mean, I guess that is a part of the landscape. Birds, fire ants. I mean, everybody in Texas knows about fire ants, but do we know where they came from and where they're going? The larger sections on the air, the energy section, and all of it is highlighted with wonderful information and stories and photographs and maps and data that I think every Texan should have. And again, this book is the Texas Landscape Project. I have been talking to one of its authors, David Todd, and this book is available at Texas A&M Press. And you can just, I don't have the website in front of me, but you can Google it and find the book right there. And I think every coffee table in Texas needs this book and the Texas Legacy Project, which has been the highlight of my coffee table for 5 years. So again, this is you're listening to KEOS Community Radio, and it is just about time for Listen Globally. So I'm going to send out this interview with another Texas singer-songwriter, and this is Traveling Texas. That would help.
Traveling,
there we go.
Texas. Been riding 4 days. Traveling Texas. Is an old cowboy's dream. Heading south to the valley in that old Spanish rain. Traveling Texas. The old cowboy sings. Ain't the heart of a Mustang that can never be tamed. Out an old blue north, across the panhandle plains. Traveling Texas, neath the moon and the sun. Traveling Texas, these highways roll on. Southbound by Houston, they're moving out into space. The eyes of Texas, her hearts and her hands. Say welcome, stranger, you know Texas means friends. Where cotton is king, and cattle is king, and Willie is king, land of blue water. Lakes of gold. Thank you.